You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today on the show is Dr. Charles Camosi, associate professor of theological and social ethics at Fordham University and a practicing bioethicist. Dr. Camosi, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you, and please do call me Charlie.
So you've just written a new book called Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. And that's politics adjacent enough that I think it's going to give us kind of a good conversation for the City of Man. Can you maybe start off by telling us what is our dignity? And then we'll get into how are we losing it.
So in one sense, we can't lose our dignity because our dignity in some sense comes from God creating us in God's image and likeness, right? So that can never, no matter how much we sin, no matter how many slings and arrows we suffer, that's not going to change. But there's a different sense in which we use dignity, sometimes called attributed dignity by the culture or by a community of people, where we can, in fact, and do lose our attributed dignity, which is the basis for our legal rights, say, or our, as I say in the subtitle of the book, our fundamental legal equality. And in that sense, we have lost, or many, many of us have, and I go through in the book different populations that have lost their dignity, which undergirds fundamental legal and kind of cultural, I guess, equality as well. So, you know, I mean, we'll get into it throughout the show, I'm sure, but in just in one sense, if you label all prenatal human beings, say, non-persons, they don't count as persons under the Constitution. That is, in one sense, that especially if state laws, which have reflected a defense of their dignity, are overturned, how a population loses its dignity.
And because you draw that distinction, right, the image of God compared to the sort of cultural dignity, this question isn't quite as relevant, but I'm still curious about the answer. What is the image of God? How would you define that?
Oh boy, I don't really talk about that in the book because it's such a controverted question among Christians, which is maybe one reason why you're asking it.
Yeah, so I had someone on last year before, who literally had written a book with image of God in the title, and when I asked him that, he dodged the question. So
you're in good
company if you do the same.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll totally dodge it. I mean, I'm with St. Thomas Aquinas, who says that the image of God is reflected in us insofar as we have the capacity to know and love God. And by capacity, he doesn't mean the actualized capacity. He makes a philosophical distinction, as I think we all should, between capacities that we have based on the kind of creatures we are, the kind of creatures God created us to be from womb to tomb, as it were, and the kinds of capacities that are actualized, where we're actually coming to know and love God. So a baby, for instance, newborn baby, not avoiding the whole abortion debate altogether, a newborn baby obviously doesn't know and love God in the same way that we do, but she's still nevertheless the same kind of creature that has the capacities within her very nature to know and love God. And so that's you know, we could get more into what it means to know and love God, and I do in some of the other stuff that I've written and discussed, but I guess maybe I'd just leave it at that.
Yeah, and again, that's obviously a long conversation in the whole Christian tradition that won't be resolved here. By focusing on that kind of second side of dignity, right? So by using cultural definition is maybe too crass a way to put it, right? But by using that question of equality within society, one of my concerns there is by disconnecting it from the image of God, we end up in sort of a relativism that says, well, look, it's just whoever controls the society gets to decide that. So what's wrong with someone saying such and such does not count as a human person?
Well, nothing. I mean, if someone wants to say this chair in my office doesn't count as a human person, I'm perfectly fine.
Or does count as a human person.
Or does. We just need to make arguments and marshal evidence that's consistent in applying that point of view. And one of my points in the book is that this is really not what we're doing. Or if we are doing it, we're kind of doing it on two tracks. We kind of imagine, on the one hand, that it's human beings, fellow members of the species Homo sapiens, that all share in this dignity. But in reality, this play, and this is where my book really focuses on healthcare, where this is really taken off. In reality, the halls of power, and again, healthcare, where life and death decisions are disproportionately made and discussed and decided on, we're really on this other kind of track, where human equality or equality of persons really depends not on your common humanity, but on your actualized traits, like I said before, like autonomy, productivity, rationality, self-awareness, these kinds of things. So I'm perfectly fine. We have to make distinctions. Not every creature, of course, not every object is, of course, a human being with equality. We need to be able to say what individuals fall into this category and which do not. But at the same time, I'd like to make sure that we're all on the same page when we're having these debates. And it seems like we have this kind of two-track debate, as it were. One, which, again, we presume that we're all talking about human beings, whereas on other tracks, we're clearly not. We're clearly saying not all human beings actually count as our equals, but human beings that have certain actualized traits.
So at what point does something become a person, then? What is the line that we should be using?
So I think there are lots of non-human persons, because I believe in angels and demons, for instance. So I think
although we're less concerned with their healthcare, right?
I think that's probably right. But if you're asking about, you know, when we should think about when a human person comes into existence, then that's just identified with there being a common human nature, right? So when does the human nature present? When there's a human organism present. And that's from the completion of fertilization until, death, which, as you know, having read the book, can be debated. But I would use a cardiopulmonary definition of death when homeostasis totally breaks down and the body starts to decompose.
So you would start with fertilized cell and end with cardiopulmonary. That's kind of your brackets there.
Yeah, I would use what biologists continue to use for the beginning of a human organism at the beginning of life, and I would use what they used to use before we started needing vital organs to be transplanted into other people, which was cardiopulmonary definition. Now, many use a so-called brain death criteria, but as I detail in the book, that really came about mostly as a result of needing a different definition of death to, in order to justify the transplantation of vital organs, which I'm a vital organ donor myself. But really, the history of this wasn't about a coherent kind of argument about who counts as us or when is a human person come into existence or come out of existence, go out of existence, but really about, hey, we just need a new definition of death so we can have more organs to give to people who need them.
Yeah, and obviously the definition sort of stretches across several of these. Definition of person is going to stretch across several of the issues you bring up in the book, from everything from abortion to keeping people on machines when they would not continue to live otherwise, right? I'm forgetting what the term for that is.
I do want to make a distinction between, discontinuing extraordinary care and treatment where you're foreseeing but not intending that death is the likely result, and saying this individual is not a person anymore. Like in the example I give of Jahi McMath in the chapter on brain death, there's a very famous bioethicist who's always on CNN called Art Kaplan, who said she's a corpse and her body's going to start to decompose. Right. I think it in some cases it would be perfectly legitimate to not keep Jahi McMath alive. What I don't want to say is that she is somehow dead. And even though, interestingly, the state of California declared her dead before she got her first period. And while she was declared dead by the state of California, she got her first period. She reached puberty while she was supposedly dead. So I'm deeply, deeply concerned with making sure that we make distinctions between treatment which is ordinary or required and allowing removal of life-sustaining treatment that is extraordinary or not required. But what I don't want to do again is tell us the bedtime story that someone who just got their first period is dead.
Now, as people in the historic Christian tradition, we do have a dualistic view of human beings, right? We are physical bodies and we are spiritual, not bodies, but whatever, spiritual entities as well. Your definition here in our conversation, and to some extent in the book, is focused entirely on the physical body. Is that fair?
No, because I mean, the way I've come to understand the term dualism is in a more negative way, that somehow there's this spiritual part of ourselves, and then there's this physical part of ourselves, and we're kind of like ghosts in a machine, right? Like, you know, where the real self is the spiritual self, and it's kind of like working inside this body, almost like animating it somehow.
Right.
And you're not your body, really. That's the kind of dualism that, at least from my perspective, I've come to understand. And I reject that dualism without saying that we're just our bodies. Of course not. We're not, as Yoda says, this crude matter, right? We are a combination of body and soul. We have a kind of, to use a fancy phrase, hylomorphic reality. We're both body and soul, deeply, deeply interconnected. This is why it was important for Jesus, frankly, to be shown after the resurrection not to be a ghost. He was he invited people to touch him, put hands in his side to show that he was flesh. So I think we're a hylomorphic combination of body and soul, and so it would be wrong to say we're just this crude matter, just as it would be wrong to say we're just the ghost in the machine or something like that.
Right, and obviously on whatever level the body and the soul are unified, right, entwined or whatever, there is a temporary period where there will be some kind of separation between body and soul until they're restored again in the second coming and the new heavens and the new earth and so forth. Trying to keep the language vague here, how do we account for that when we're thinking about something like death? Again, if our strict definition is the cardiopulmonary definition, I'm just wanting to be sure that our definition, if it can, as people in this tradition, how can we hold those two strains together?
Yeah, boy, we're getting into deep waters very quickly here, and way, way far away from politics. But
yeah, I don't want that written into the law, by the way.
You know, it's interesting. There's lots of people who've done lots of great work on this stuff, who aren't, practical ethicists like myself. But there's a range of debates about this. So, for instance, there are some people that will say when you get outside of space-time, as the next life is, it's really not the same. You can't really talk about, like, there is this time where you exist apart from your body, right? So we who exist in space-time find it difficult to imagine that. Like, what do you mean there's no time? Of course there is, because there is your dead body and your soul goes somewhere else, right? Well, that's using a framework, the only framework we have, one of space-time, to kind of imagine what this would be like. But the kingdom of God is really, unlike if it's out, if it is outside of space-time, which I think it is, then it's really very, very difficult for us to imagine what this is even like to even use categories of space and time along the lines that we have available to us. So, you know, this is above my pay grade in terms of the stuff that I've studied and read, but there are lots of people, lots of good theologians who will say there really isn't an experience of life that we have without our bodies. We will have a glorified body like Christ himself had in the kingdom of God, and there isn't a time that we exist without it. I don't know how to make sense of a claim like that, just like I don't know how to make sense of an existence that exists outside of space-time. But I guess that's the best that I have, as somebody that's not trained in this stuff and doesn't do a whole lot of thinking about it.
Well, and I raised the question because I could see that being a counterpoint to some of your arguments, again, on both ends of human life, to the, you know, when does life begin? On the one hand, well, fertilization, is that when the unity of body and soul begins, or is it at some point later? So heartbeat is one of the common arguments that I hear. And then in terms of death on the other side, again, is brain death maybe a sign that from our perspective, not currently being in the kingdom of God, that now that separation has, you know, temporarily occurred? That's kind of where that question was going originally.
Yeah, no, I got that. And I appreciate the push. And it seems as though that there are two different kinds of questions that are related, but maybe separate. So there's the question of, okay, if we die, what does it mean to say that we live apart from our bodies as a soul? And, or if we do, what does that mean? And then what does it mean to have a living member of our species without a soul? Right. So traditionally, the very anima, the animating part of the soul, or the part of who we are, is the soul. So for us to talk about a living human being, a fellow member of the species Homo sapiens, without an anima, without a soul, without that spiritual aspect of who we are, seems strange to me. It seems odd that we would say, for instance, again, Jahi McMath, or maybe Terry Schiavo is even the better example. So in the book, Terry Schiavo, many of the listeners hearing our conversation will know that in the late 90s and early aughts, there was this huge blow up over her existence, whether she was alive or dead, or whether we should be able to take her off of life support, and who should decide that. Well, as I detail in the book, her husband ended up winning that battle over her parents, who wanted to continue to care for her. And he wrote on her gravestone that she had departed this earth in 1990 and was at peace in 2005 when they stopped feeding and hydrating her. What does it mean to say that somebody who is in a so-called vegetative state, which I actually find that term offensive, Terry Schiavo was not a vegetable, though she was severely brain damaged. What does it mean to say that somebody who had sleep and wake cycles and reacted to music being played in her room? When I give talks on my book now, I actually show the picture of her gravestone, then I show a picture of her reacting to music being played in her room. Now, she, of course, was very, very traumatically brain injured, and it got worse over time over those 15 years. But one of the things that we found out is that with the right kind of therapies, we now know that people in a so-called vegetative state can actually come out of that state. That with the right kind of therapies, we've had people who were declared in a vegetative state who have been able to communicate, and who have through blinking, through being able to think in certain ways, and fMRI machines, be able to determine whether they're thinking about playing tennis or reading in their room, and be able to answer yes or no questions that way. But Terry Schiavo's husband wrote on her gravestone, or had written on her gravestone, that she had departed this earth in 1990. So even if you're right, and I don't think you are, I don't know if you're just playing devil's advocate, or I don't if even if somebody
definitely devil's advocate there.
But even if somebody is going to say hey, you can have a living human being or a living member of Homo sapiens, and the soul has gone, the soul has left, then we're left with even more questions to ask. Well, when exactly does that happen? Because Terry Schiavo's husband thought it happened in 1990, when she was in a vegetative state. But we've shown that actually that's not the case, because we can now, with the right therapies, at least in a good number of cases, help heal or in part heal people in circumstances like that.
Yeah, just for the record, I make no definitive claim to know when life begins. And I think there's probably a point when we can definitely know when it's over, but there's also some gray area at the end, too. As we said in one of our country music episodes, Elvis is certainly dead by now, whatever else is going on. You talk, as you mentioned, you talk about Terri Schiavo, which our younger listeners probably won't know, but listeners of a certain age will remember that. You talk about Roe, you talk about late-stage dementia and degenerative disease, neurodegenerative disease. Those are all things that undercut things that undercut the physical health of the individual. Where in our responses to each of those do you see that we are losing our dignity? Again, to stick with your title, how is our cultural reaction affecting the way that we view people who are undergoing again neurodegenerative disease and late stage dementia and so on?
The basis for our fundamental human equality was the dignity offered by being created in the image and likeness of God, as you already mentioned. For most of this country's history, that is how we thought about these things. Now, we didn't apply it perfectly by any stretch of the imagination. And in some ways, we're doing a better job of applying that principle than we have done before, say, when it comes to racial justice or in some cases, how we treat the disabled or something like that. Women, minorities, that sort of thing. And that's very important. But in another way, we're doing a much worse job in the sense that we've just decided whole populations don't count. So in part because we've had this shift. I mean, in some ways we're running on two tracks, as I mentioned before, but in some ways we've just straight up no chaser shifted to a kind of actualized traits version of where dignity comes from. So you have dignity because you're autonomous, because you're rational, self-aware, productive, you have a will that you can express, etc. And to the extent that we take those that view seriously, and many do, it's just obvious that many members of the human family don't count as the members of the personal family, with person being defined this way, because they don't have rationality, self-awareness, autonomy, and productivity. A prenatal child certainly doesn't. I've done some work on Peter Singer. He's a philosopher at Princeton who says, by the way, the newborn child doesn't either. And we need to be pro-choice for infanticide, which I think he's right about. If you start with being pro-choice for abortion, you should also be pro-choice for infanticide for very similar reasons. The when you move towards those who have traumatic brain injuries, we talked about, so-called brain death and so-called vegetative state already. But if you think about the cases of Alfie Evans and Charlie Gard, I get into that, where we say, you know, these toddlers, they're very clearly living members of the human family, pink, plump. Their bodies, apart from their brains, are very, very healthy, very, very vital, in fact, vigorous even. But their brains are severely damaged by kind of neurodegenerative disease. In both cases, I think we didn't even know what it was exactly that was causing the problem. I make the case in the book that this is an erosion of another line, where there's another category of human beings that don't count the same as others. As you may remember, and your listeners may remember, there was even a plane ready to take Alfie Evans from, I think, London to Rome, where Pope Francis himself had said, we will treat him at Bamboo Jesu Children's Hospital in Rome right now. We'll pay for everything. We'll take care of it all. No problem. And the UK still didn't let him go. And then where I'm really focused in the book towards the end, and I'm really trying to sound the alarm, as it were, is if we apply this vision of dignity to human beings at the end of life, not just in the cases of brain death or vegetative state, but in late stage dementia, it's very clear those populations don't have rationality, self-awareness, autonomy, and productivity the same way that we do, or in some cases at all. And I think we're already starting to see the way we treat those populations as reflecting that we don't really, I mean, we haven't officially said they don't count the same as us, but the kind of warehouses of death in which we keep them, the kind of judgments we make about their quality of life, the way we sedate them. There was just a New York Times expose done which showed that they're diagnosed at 15 times the normal rate of having some kind of psychosis, such that they would need drugs to kind of calm them down, but or to address the psychosis or the multiple personality disorder or something like that. But really, the reason that they're diagnosed this way is not because they have multiple personality disorder, but because they want to give them the drugs to essentially sedate them and keep them docile so they don't have to take care of them like they would other people. And not to undersell what a challenge it is to take care of people with late-stage dementia. It's a huge challenge. We'll have to decide if we want to put the resources into this or not. And that's frankly, maybe I'll finish this point with this final point. Throughout the book, I'm hyper concerned to show that it's allocation of resources which is actually driving a lot of this. It's not the arguments, which I like to have fun arguments with people about when ensoulment takes place or when someone dies. It's more about like, well, we think it would be really hard for resource reasons to take care of folks like this, so we will just put them into this category. That's what happened when it came to brain death. I think that's what a lot of people have in mind when they think about kind of wasting resources on vegetables, like Terry Schiavo. UK system has a very explicitly focused allocation of resource protocol based on this kind of thing called quality adjusted life years, QALYs. You can only pay for something in that system if it has a sufficient amount of quality adjusted life years that it will add to a patient. And then now we have to decide, like, are we in fact going to put the resources that are necessary into the care to care rightly, care equally for people with late stage dementia? And early signs are not good. In fact, if we had that magic eight ball that you and I may have had growing up, it might be signs point to no.
So what if you had a magic wand and you could sort of make all of that happen? So we're now properly caring for people who are in those categories. What would that look like? How would it be different than it is now? Other than presumably less sedation, but like what kind of positive action are you calling for?
Well, we'd have to make commitments on several levels. We'd almost have to fundamentally reorient our healthcare system and maybe even our culture in ways that I think are unlikely to happen, which is why I think signs point to no. I mean, even if you just focus on late stage dementia, the number of people with dementia is going to double. It's already millions and millions and millions. We're already not treating them the way we should, but it's going to double over the next 20 years. Hopefully we find a cure, but we don't appear to be close to that. If this population doubles over the next 20 years, we are in serious trouble because we are going to have to, I lay out in the book a kind of short-term, medium-term, and longer-term approach. A short-term approach would be to say, let's make our personal and familial choices in ways to really care for these populations, do the best we can to take care of them in our homes, in fact, lobby our politicians to help us take care of them in our homes by reimbursing the care we give them the way we would, you know, in a congregant setting. In fact, it's much cheaper to care for someone at home than it is in these congregant settings and nursing homes. So even something as simple as maybe encouraging our children to stick around and take care of us in our family would be an important thing to do, rather than just say, you know, fly, bird, fly, go explore your dreams. That's good, but you also have this other obligation to honor your father and mother in a particular kind of way as well, that I think is important. So there's that first kind of level, like, what do we do as individuals and families? Then there's a second level, I think, where we have to really lobby the culture and make this case in public to say that we need to return or at least hold on to, depending how you look at how far we are down the line, this vision of human dignity, which focuses on the human person. That vision is essential if we're going to, as a culture, as a polity, do the kinds of things that are necessary And it really does mean staffing. It means reimbursement rates are better. It means, reimbursing for care in the home. It means pushing against a youth obsessed culture, which thinks of old people as a kind of, and especially old disabled people as a kind of population to discard. And then finally, I suggest that if that doesn't happen in the next decade or so, and I guess I'm pessimistic about it, frankly. I mean, who knows what God can do with this, but I'm pessimistic. Then it's really up to the church and religious folks more generally. So it's not just Christians, of course, that have this vision about being made in the image and likeness of God. It's something we share with Jews and Muslims as well. Can Christians, Jews, and Muslims kind of unite if the broader culture doesn't do this to kind of orient our own churches, our own religious communities to do these things without the broader support of the culture and to be a kind of sign of contradiction, as it were. I actually go into some of the history of the Christian churches throughout the centuries doing things like this in relation to kind of medical emergencies and things like that. So it's not unrealistic in that sense. We have mobilized in very dramatic ways in the past, and we may need to do it again.
Yeah, and that sort of brings us back to the beginning of your book, right, where you talk about the secularization of medicine in the past two centuries, I guess, at this point. I think that's interesting to think through, specifically as a Christian. Now, as a Christian on the Protestant side with a fairly, I think, robust two kingdoms view, I'm going to be a little more hesitant and say, well, it's something the church can do, but it's not obligatory. But, you know, might become should if the cultural circumstances don't change. What should a revitalized and reengaged church look like if it's trying to tackle this issue?
Well, one of the things I point to is the early churches. There's lots of, as you probably know, there's just lots of historical debate that doesn't usually involve God's grace, which it probably should. But there's lots of historical debate. Like, how did this little sect of Judaism become this this kind of powerhouse within ancient Greece and Rome by the time Constantine decides he wants to essentially capitulate to it? I'm more of the view that he didn't have this kind of Battle of the Milvian Bridge, vision, but more that, like, his mom was a Christian at the time. The culture was largely being Christianized at the time. Something had already fundamentally changed before Constantine. So what happened? Well, I'm not a historian of the early church, but there are some historians who really locate it in how Christians dealt with these kinds of medical emergencies. So there were some really major plagues and, dare I say, pandemics in those early centuries, where the gravestones after the pandemics really showed that a dramatic rise in the number of Christian converts over time. And some historians have extrapolated from that something made Christianity really attractive, such that during the pandemic, such that there were apparently many more converts after than before. And we don't know, of course, but based in part on how Christians at least claimed that they did react to sickness and disease, some historians have extrapolated from this that it was probably how we reacted to these emergencies that helped us grow from being, again, a kind of obscure sect of Judaism to being the kind of faith that Constantine himself would make legal under some pressure, in my view. And if that's true, if that's right, then we really do have a history we can point to and say, you know, it doesn't necessarily involve, though I think it should involve, and you might disagree about this, I think it should involve building big institutions like hospital systems and care homes and that sort of thing. The Christians of that age, of course, didn't have those things. But what they did have is the ability to accompany people, to be Christ-like in their care for the sick, even when it was dangerous to them, even when others were fleeing. even when others didn't care. And so, I mean, that's our in some ways, that's our history. That's certainly what Christ calls us to. And so that on a certain level is what, I mean, even if we disagree about, you know, from a two kingdoms perspective, how active we should be in, you know, cultivating hospital systems or something like that. Even though the current hospital system we have comes out of, from my perspective, an explicitly Christian context, a Catholic Christian context. But even if we disagree about that, we should be able to agree that we can be like those Christians of the first few centuries of the church and orient our lives to care for population that others thought could simply be thrown away.
And of course, we should remember how impressed the ancient pagan Romans were by the armed protest at state capitals over mask mandates, right? That's really what brought them on board.
I take your point.
And I should clarify on my kind of mild two kingdoms perspective, isn't that Christians shouldn't be doing this stuff. It's just that the church shouldn't be. That's not the job of the institutional church. Christians, I think, have an obligation individually, certainly, to show mercy and to do acts of compassion and so on. And certainly as a conservative, I'm in favor of building institutions and putting up structures that do things for people and all of that. I'm 100% on board with that. I think we hit sort of the main points that I'd wanted to talk about. I don't know that I see a de-secularization of our medical care system ever, certainly not in the near future. And I don't know that it would necessarily be effective anyway, because I'm not sure that Christian churches are at a place where they are capable of taking that on. But maybe I'm being too cynical, or maybe that's too Protestant a view. Maybe it's just our side of things that's too institutionally sick, too institutionally rotting to be able to do that sort of thing. I can't speak for the Catholics.
I think you're probably right, given where we are now. But I don't know, and maybe this is Pollyannish of me, but I just wonder about if we don't meet the needs of a population already in the dozens of millions that is going to double over the next 20 years. I mean, we're going to have. I write in the book that we're either going to have to fundamentally shift our views on human dignity, or we're going to have the kind of mass scale abandonment that has already started, or we're going to have systematic euthanasia. Probably that's where we're going to move, because people are going to say, well, it's not good that, you know, people are dying essentially by being abandoned or being drugged. Why not just, you know, they die with dignity, you know?
Right.
So that kind of cultural horror show, I hope anyway, is the kind of thing that can move Christians into a different place where we're not doing protests over mask mandates, but instead like thinking how we can personally, familiarly, from a community perspective, from a church or parish perspective, think about organizing ourselves to address this cultural emergency. And, you know, again, maybe it's naive or Pollyannish of me to think that, what helps me, have such a view, what supports me in such a view is that we've done it in the past. So again, the early Christians did it. Lots of religious orders in the Catholic Church came about simply to address these kinds of issues. Most recently, the Sisters of Life in New York City were formed specifically to address the contemporary issue of abortion, for instance. Lots of orders were formed, or at least totally reorganized, to address the Spanish flu epidemic in the early part of the 20th century. The first nurses, I'm finishing up a book on nursing bioethics for Christians. The first nurses were essentially orders of Catholic nuns who were employed during the Civil War, because there weren't anything like really nurses around and they needed them. So there's just this history of trying to meet the moment that I don't think comes from human energies. I think it comes from God's grace and God's cajoling. But I'm just hopeful we can get that gift again to meet this particular emergency.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I am not encouraged by what we've seen over the last year and a half with COVID, whether individual Christian responses or institutional responses, but maybe we will learn something from the pandemic and adjust our practices and attitudes accordingly. Optimistic, but...
Yeah. I hope so. God can do a lot. I mean, the fact that the Catholic Church still exists despite all its horrors and terrible mistakes is some evidence that it's not our own virtue that is guiding things here. So hopefully God can guide us in a better direction.
Well, anything you'd like to add in closing here? I want to respect your time and we'll let you get on to your next meeting.
No, thank you. This was a fun conversation.
Yeah. It's a good book. I'll encourage our listeners to go out and pick up Losing Our Dignity by Charles Camosi. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high